The Tom Woods Show, episode 1349.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, make 2019 the year you finally start that side hustle online. I can't tell you how many knuckleheads are out there cleaning up online, and you are smarter than a knucklehead. Go grab my free ebook based on my own experience in doing precisely this over at PathsToIncome.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I am doing something I have not done in over 2 years. I'm taking an episode of what I call my sister podcast, Contra Krugman, which I host once a week with Bob Murphy, and we critique a New York Times column by Paul Krugman, and I'm making it into an episode of The Tom Woods Show. Now, some of you who listen to Contra Krugman regularly will have heard this episode already. I think it bears hearing again, but of course, I also have 1,348 other episodes you can entertain yourselves with today if you prefer not to hear it again. But this is an opportunity for my regular listeners to get a sample of Contra Krugman, and I'd like them to have that chance because lately we've been doing some really great ones, and Bob and I have been having a lot of fun together. So that's what I'm doing for today's episode. So here we go. I have stripped out the beginning and ending music for Contra Krugman and given you just the substance. So get ready. We're going to have some fun. Hey, everybody. It's Tom and Bob back again with another episode of Contra Krugman. And this time, even though we're recording this in, I guess, the very beginning of the third week of January, all the same, we are reaching back about a month back into 2018 to pull out a column from Krugman that's just too rich to leave uncommented on. And it's one of these things where lately Krugman he's been on fire. He's been on a roll with crazy columns. So we've had a surfeit of columns. We really haven't known what to do with them. So we kept this one in reserve from so long ago, we haven't been able to get to it. We're finally able to get to it today. And it is called The Case for a Mixed Economy. The subtitle is Maybe Not Everything Should Be Privatized. I'm shocked to hear Krugman say that. December 22nd, 2018. So we'll link to that at ContraKrugman.com/173. As usual, so you can check it out for yourself and or follow along with us. All right, Bob, I am ready to go now, my second week in a row back doing the summary. If you have anything to say before I do that, we'd be delighted to hear it. Otherwise, off I go.
I just love this because now if somebody says, oh yeah, Krugman's such a commie, the most he can say is not fully. So
that's right, not fully indeed. So let's take a look at what we got here. He says, he's saying that what we're faced with ultimately at a fundamental level is a choice between markets and, well, you know, not markets. That's really what it boils down to. Markets and some kind of public ownership. So he says, maybe with some decentralization of control, but still more or less what we used to mean by socialism. And he says, and then there's a lack of clarity about socialism because everybody either just says socialism is discredited or they take social welfare, social insurance programs, and they call them socialism, but that's not really what used to be meant by the word. So now Krugman is saying he's been wondering lately, how discredited is socialism really? And he says, yeah, it's true. Nobody now imagines that what we really need is a centrally planned economy. But he's not convinced that we've established that markets are the best way to do everything. Should everything be done by the private sector? I don't think so, says Krugman. So he says, education, the public sector clearly does better. Healthcare, the case for privatization, private supply of healthcare is very weak. And then you add these sectors up and you get a pretty big result. And he says, it's true communism failed, but there's still a pretty good case for a mixed economy. So a mixed economy, meaning you've got some markets, some private property, but then you've got a substantial government presence where the government may in fact be running some, you know, entire industries, let's say. So he says, you could imagine running a fairly efficient economy that's only two-thirds capitalist, one-third publicly owned, i.e. some kind of socialist. So then he's, you know, he tries to explain how he comes up with that particular fraction. And he says, there's no reason to think that education, health, social assistance, these areas where we see so much government involvement, there's no reason to think the private sector does these things better. And he says for-profit education is actually a disaster area. So it would be quite possible to imagine an economy where the bulk of education, health, and social assistance that's currently in the private sector became public. And then he thinks of other private activities that could plausibly be public. So utilities, for example, private health insurance. He says it's not clear that really serves much of a role. He says areas like retail, trade, or manufacturing don't seem suitable for public ownership. But even there, you could see some cases. So we could have the public manufacture, for example, of generic drugs. So put this all together, and as I said, as Krugman said, you could see an economy working well with something like one-third public ownership. Now, this is not going to satisfy the capitalism haters out there. And he says, I also see no chance of any of this happening in his lifetime, or my working lifetime. He says, but he said, I do think it's worth trying to think a bit beyond our current paradigm, which says that anything you could call socialist has been an utter failure. Maybe not so much, question mark. And that's the column. Now, Bob, lately I think I've been doing these summaries, and then I just go on a tear. Maybe I dreamed that or I'm imagining it. I don't know. Whether it's true or not, I'm going to let you take the opening crack at this one, partly because I'm curious about what struck you the most about this column.
Well, you weren't dreaming, Tom. You have, in fact, been doing that, just to confirm.
Okay. All right.
The dream a reality.
Okay. I was going to say, those would have been glorious, perfectly fine, wonderful dreams, but reality is even better. All right. So you go ahead and do this, and I'll sit here and dream about myself talking.
Sure. So I think my initial, besides my original crack, that the reason I loved this so much was that, now, I guess commie's the wrong phrase. If someone says Krugman's a socialist, he can say only one third. So, you know, let's be more accurate. And that's not putting words in his mouth, right? Like, that's what his column here is saying.
Yeah.
I guess, so one thing is Krugman's being a little bit vague about who's introducing the confusion over what socialism means nowadays. Because, geez, back in the day, it meant government ownership of the means of production. But people thinking that welfare state programs are socialism, that doesn't line up right. He doesn't mention any names, but I can think of some people that might lead the public to be confused on that matter. And it's not Newt Gingrich.
Indeed. We'll leave it to the student as an exercise.
Right. So I guess on the one hand, I should be grateful, you know, that Krugman is making that distinction. And this is something that I know Ben Powell, you know, he has his book coming out, as you know, Tom, with Bob Lawson on they're going around to actual socialist places around the world and you know, discussing it. And that's one of the points that they make, is to say that pointing at Sweden, for example, and calling that socialism is just nutty. That for one thing, on the Economic Freedom of the World Index, places like Denmark and Sweden, they're competitive, right? They have relatively high degrees of economic freedom. One of the quick data points on this is simply that the corporate income tax rate, for example, folks, until the recent reform, where it was brought from 35 percentage points down to 21, the U.S. had one of the highest corporate income tax rates in the world. Okay, so just things like a lot of these places that are hailed as meccas of democratic socialism don't have minimum wage laws, for example. Right, so yes, there's not some Rothbard land out there that we can point to because it doesn't exist. But the point is, a lot of these things that are held and held up as examples of democratic socialism in operation, they actually have a mixture. So yes, they have big welfare states, but they also have low tax rates in certain sectors, or they have, they don't have a minimum wage, things like that. And the other element too is, as I know you've underscored on your show, Tom, when you talk about this topic, is that a lot of these places were genuinely free market economies decades ago, and that's how they became rich. And it was only when they had the luxury to be able to afford a giant welfare state that they then implemented it, and then that's actually slowed their economic growth since then. Do you want to chime in on that, Tom, since I'm actually just parroting a lot of what I've heard from your show?
About this, just the Scandinavian situation?
Sure.
Yeah, and I will say, by the way, I'm familiar with the Powell and Lawson book, which it's called Socialism Sucks, and the subtitle is Two Economists Drink Their Way Through the Unfree World. That's a really clever subtitle, because I'm actually writing the foreword to that book. How about that? So, yeah, they've done it. They've done a good job with it. Yeah. First of all, I want to say I am seriously considering doing a free ebook where I bring together the stuff that has been done on my show about Scandinavia. And I've actually thought of calling it, because I know I have this kind of shtick where I have ebooks called "Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare." I hadn't heard that.
That wasn't on my radar.
Yeah, I know. I've been keeping it under wraps.
You give out ebooks? I didn't.
Yeah. I know it. Huh. I know it. I got to do a better job with it.
Have you considered emailing people? I hear the latest thing is like to have an email list. I don't know if you've thought of it.
I had somebody today in my private group say, "Huh? I'm not kidding. He was in deadly earnest. How do I get on your email list?" And I thought, I must suck at this. So anyway, so I'm thinking of doing one called "Your Facebook Friends," or I may substitute it as "Your Socialist Friends Are Wrong About Sweden" or "Wrong About Scandinavia." And I just don't know if that's too wonkish of a book, or like an ebook, like, you know, 80 pages, let's say. Mm-hmm. Is that too wonkish, or are so many people getting hit with this that they would want to read an ebook like that? Let me ask you, what do you think?
I think you should definitely do it. I mean, I don't know how many people are going to read it cover to cover, but I think it would be good. A lot of people would want it to have, you know, the ammunition, because they know.
Right, they want to know that it's
right,
there.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, when you go through the arguments, I mean, I've done episodes on my show. I've done an episode on Norway, one or two episodes on Denmark, several episodes on Sweden. And what we basically concluded is I like what Johan Norberg says. How do you build a small fortune? Answer, you start with a large fortune and you just whittle it away.
Right.
And he says that's kind of the story of Sweden, is that, yeah, we were wealthy because, you know, in the 1950s, we even had lower government spending as a percentage of GDP than the United States had. And we kept out of war. I mean, we did all these sensible classical liberal sorts of things. And so we built up a lot of capital, so to speak. And then we whittled that away with the welfare state. I mean, a couple things to note about the welfare state is not really as redistributive in Scandinavia as you would think. It's a lot of the middle class, you know, picking money out of one of its pockets and putting it back into another pocket. That's one thing. Secondly, their business climate is much better than you would think. And that's really partly why they rank so highly on the Economic Freedom of the World indexes, because of that, because of the regulatory environment, the tax burden on business. And so not like it's a, you know, it's not a libertarian paradise, but basically
so
what's going on.
It's no Somalia is what you're saying.
It's no Somalia, but they're harnessing, in other words, the mechanism of capitalism and then taking some of the proceeds and redistributing those. But even there, if you look at the numbers like of new business startups and entrepreneurship, it's been very poor since the social insurance experiment. And then I wish I could remember the exact dates, but there's a very interesting statistic about from about the start of that experiment around the 70s up through the turn of the century, the net number of private sector jobs created was zero. I mean, zero. That's what happened to the private sector. And then it's also worth noting, people say, oh, look at how well the Swedes are doing. Well, for whatever reason, no matter where the Swedes live, they do well, no matter where in the world. This was a phenomenon that Thomas Sowell looked at in a lot of his books. So, for example, in his book, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality, he noted that the Germans did very well. You know, if they settled in Brazil or wherever, all the locals commented on how hardworking they were. And he says, now I realize this is forbidden testimony. You know, we're not allowed to note that people are hardworking. Well, likewise with Swedes. So when they come to America, now you could say it's a selection bias, but I think you can correct for that. But the long and the short of it is the Swedes in America do about twice as well as they do in Sweden itself. So yeah, even when they're in the terrible dog-eat-dog capitalism of America, they do even better, it turns out. So, you know, you take it all together and And then half the time when you're looking at things like, let's say, infant mortality, it has to do with how you're defining a birth, because for they define it differently so as to not include a lot of obvious deaths in the statistics. So if you actually measure them the way the United States measures them, there's not nearly the gap that you see. So some of this is just playing with numbers too. So that's just the stuff off the top of my head, but we'll link in the show notes to further information on this. In fact, I'll jot this down, make a note to myself right now about this. Scandinavian resources. And by the way, I know we have some Scandinavians who listen to this show, and I find that amazing that you would care enough about some American newspaper columnist that you would want to hear him refuted. I think it's because they care more about you and me, Bob, and that's what really moves me. But I would say to all you folks out there listening in Sweden, et cetera, and if you're included in one of those et cetera countries, I'm sorry, but if you're listening to us now, you have a particular task to perform here. You have a role at this moment in history where democratic socialism is really, really taking is really getting a lot of attention, and people are pointing to your countries as the examples. You have to help rescue us. You need to be writing more and speaking more and making more videos, because if you disagree with that, help us, right? You know better than we do what's going on over there. What the heck do Bob and I know about Denmark? Didn't stop us from doing an episode on it, though.
Exactly. So back to Krugman, I think – so I guess on the one hand, we should be grateful that he's acknowledging that, okay, yeah, what a lot of people are referring to as socialism nowadays, no, that's really just the welfare state, and that, you know, that's not what we used to mean. But still, I mean, it's funny to me, Tom, how he has – like, this is an actual sentence in this article. But I've been wondering exactly how discredited is socialism really? And you'd think, you know, maybe he might just mention – the millions of people that died under socialist regimes, for example, or, you know, the tremendous gap in living standards between like North and South Korea or East and West Germany, things like, not a word of that. And so I guess when you're asking me, Tom, you know, what's my initial reaction besides the one I already shared with you, it was to say, if I were an actual socialist reading Krugman's column, I would think he was just an establishment sellout, because this column is nothing but saying the areas in which public ownership clearly outperforms private ownership, and he doesn't give – correct me if I'm wrong. You had to read this in order to summarize it. Does Krugman give you any sense whatsoever of why private ownership and self-interest actually are good things to be used in these other sectors? He just makes offhand statements like, oh, yeah, nobody's talking about central planning. Well why not?
Right. What are the virtues?
Yeah, he doesn't
what
give,
are the virtues?
He doesn't give any theoretical explanation for why in some areas – private enterprise is superior, and he doesn't give a single historical, you know, aside as to, you know, because they tried it and such. He just, and so I think that's kind of weird. And I think part of it is he doesn't feel comfortable talking about the millions of people who died under Stalin or Mao, because it just, that's not something that a left progressive talks about. Am I being too suspicious here? Am I reading too much into this?
No. I mean, I was... You remember the last time, was it last week? No, it wasn't last. It was a couple weeks ago. We talked about a column where Krugman – well, I think it was where he was talking about high marginal income tax rates for the rich. And he was – at no time did we get any sense from him that rich people do anything of value. There was no sense of that. And then he even says that tax policy should be made without any consideration for the interests of the rich. It's just so they're not even people – we're not even sure what their role in the economy is. They're probably doing something. You know, who knows what they're doing. But the key thing is, if they keep working, then we can tax them. And that's the thing. So there was no pause to consider, well, gee, what role do they play? Now, he's an economist. He must understand something about what they do. And so that was actually what I was getting from this column, that he's willing to have two-thirds of the economy be run privately, and yet – there isn't even one statement as to why he would want that two-thirds. I mean, what are the benefits of having private ownership of anything? It's never discussed. There are no virtues that are ever described. It's just that, of course, nobody wants a planned economy. But why not? Exactly what are the exact reasons? We never get that from him. It's like he can't stand it. He can't – but yet – I mean, I don't know. I've just never heard him say – even though I know in his heart of hearts he thinks of himself as basically being a mixed economy capitalist, I've never heard him talk about the benefits of the system he supposedly favors.
Right. Actually, I did find literally one sentence here, Tom. He says, in other words, comma, while communism failed, comma, there's still a pretty good case for a mixed economy, da 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 da. So, and he has communism with a capital C. So I guess there he is making a – like what, three words. So of the column, I stand corrected. He devoted three words to the historical fact that there, you know, some might say that there's a failure of communism. But
all right. So in other words, we tried it and it doesn't work. So now we're going to try something else. So it's not like, well, here's how economic calculation works. or here are the benefits of private property, or here's the role of capital investment, or something. It's, the best he can do is, well, you know, we tried taking everything away from you bozos, and that didn't work.
Yeah.
So we'll try this thing. It's not good.
And for the listener, the reason I'm harping on this, and I think Tom as well, is how would anybody reading this column know how to evaluate these things without knowing, well, why did communism fail? You know what I mean? Because maybe it was just the wrong people were in charge. That's what communists would say. And so,
right,
you know, it's if Krugman's giving no reason here, you know, no understanding of, well, gee, like we're saying, or he's saying, oh yeah, it should be maybe one third publicly owned and two thirds capitalist. Well, why? Why not 4/5 publicly owned and 1/5 capitalist? How would you know? He doesn't give any explanation. So that, I mean, that's, to me, that was part of what was so annoying about this, is I wanted to get into the heart of it. And yes, Tom, I was curious to see what was Krugman's case for private property. I would love to hear him make that case just to see, you know, does he really have one, or is it more about, well, yeah, you know, people are greedy deep down, and so you kind of have to have their self-interest somehow involved. You know, I'm guessing that's what it would be. It would be kind of a surface, you know, incentive thing, and he would grudgingly admit. But like you're saying, Tom, what's so funny about that is, you know, since he thinks, at least in the standard competitive model, everybody gets out of the economy what he or she puts into it, you know, it would be sort of like, well, yeah, why is self-interest important? Because, you know, all that means is any particular individual, like the rich people, you know, whatever they contribute, that's what they take out. And so it doesn't really affect the rest of us, whether they're motivated or not. And by the way, folks, I'm not putting words in his mouth. We'll put a link to it in the show notes page. It wasn't in the most recent thing where Krugman was defending the high marginal income tax rates. It was a previous column, I want to say from like 2012, where he went through it much more systematically and actually said, so even if high marginal tax rates makes all these wheeler dealers work, you know, 2/3 as hard, so they withdraw 1/3 of their labor effort, and he explicitly says that doesn't affect any of us in the slightest. It just means, you know, those people's salaries go down by that offsetting amount. And so the rest of us, our real incomes are unaffected. So it, you know, it really is the case that it's not obvious why Krugman thinks that harnessing self-interest is such a big deal, since, as we've said, oh yeah, you get people to work more, but that just means they get to consume more.
Do we want to, I mean, I'm not a policy wonk, and I know that there have been studies that dispute the superiority of private schools. Krugman just takes for granted that public schools are superior to private. Regardless of the outcome of that.
Well, can I stop you? Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because he did an interesting move. He was saying for-profit education. And I thought that was an interesting, because, I mean, clearly, by any metric, private schools are better than so-called public schools. And then I think the way the left would respond to that is to say, well, yeah, that's because all the rich people send their kids to the private schools, and then, you know, the government schools are left with, you know, the ones that haven't been coddled since birth. So no kidding, the SAT scores, which, you know, fair enough. I mean, I get that that's a thing you want to control for. But I mean, clearly, if you're saying is a private school, you know, are private schools better at educating people than so-called public schools? I mean, that can't possibly even be close. And so that's not what Krugman contrasted with, is the failures of for-profit education. So I guess what he means, you know, he's not considering a private school that's technically classified as a nonprofit. Do you agree with what I'm saying, Dom?
Yeah, that probably is the case. That's probably the case. I mean, look, I've been in all these scenarios, private, public, you know, either with me or the kids or whatever. We've done all different sorts of things, and I've dealt with people throughout my life in the different, and it is night and day. I mean, only a wonk with no hands-on experience could make a statement like that. It's a night and day difference. The whole attitude of the administration at a public versus a private school. The public school, they know full well they have so many customers, it does not matter. If you're unhappy, it does not matter. If your kid is being bullied and terrorized, oh yeah, 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 they have an anti-bullying poster right over here. We told you we had an anti-bullying program. See, it's the poster. That's our program. Nothing gets done. That kid continues to terrorize other people. Whereas in the private school, they just go out of their way to make you happy. I mean, I just see that again and again and again. I mean, we can argue. The thing is, overall, I don't, regardless of the public versus private thing, I don't think I'd go out of my way to say anything about the school system if I were on the other side of this argument, because when you look at the results, I mean, they have actually measured how people do and how much they know. And they are generating people who don't know anything about anything. And then after 4 years of college, they know even less than they went in some subject areas. Not in a million years would I want to say, oh, this has been a big success. I mean, if I wanted somebody who could do robotic tasks and repeat back to me things I said, it would be an okay system because I would say 40% of them can do that. But it's unbelievable how little they know about anything. They certainly know which words to use and which recycling receptacle to put their plastic bottle in. They know. Anyway, I could just go on forever. But they certainly don't know anything about I don't see that they leave the system with a marketable skill. If they do, what is it? What skill do they leave with? I don't see any. So anyway, I've gone on that rant before, but I don't see why the private sector couldn't do it.
You had Brian Kaplan on your show, right, Tom?
Yeah.
Why don't we link to that? Yeah just for people who don't know.
Let's link to Brian Kaplan.
And I haven't read his book, but I've heard, you know, I've seen him write about it and talk about it.
Oh, it's tremendous.
And I think what some people probably don't realize is one of the, you know, amazing things that he was doing, that it was just showing surveys of just, you know, standard tests of basic knowledge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And whatever you think, whatever you think you've heard about this, it's worse.
Yeah. It wasn't like, hey, what's the sixth digit of pi? And only 10% of Americans knew that. No, it's not like that. it's like, you know, how many senators are there? Things of that nature. Even that's probably one of the harder ones. So it's really basic stuff. And the percentages of people with, you know, high school diploma, college diploma who get it is shockingly low. And so it's – and also too, Tom, I mean, I know what the answer is, Tom. It's because of all these right-wing Republican governments that have starved the education sector of public money to fund tax cuts for the rich. So that's your explanation, smart guy.
Yeah, exactly. Except since the probably mid to late 70s, in real terms, education funding has doubled. So it's just – there's just no defending this. And not to mention, I've also had on James Tooley. I've had him on a couple of times, who's talked about how in the developing world, low-cost private schools are without a doubt outperforming the public schools, without a doubt, because it's been looked at. They're outperforming them. They're educating more students. Their costs are lower. They're more effective overall, and now he's trying to bring a no-frills model to the UK for people who want to – I mean, look, if the system were working that well, why would people want to get their kids out of it in order to go pay even for a no-frills education? I mean, surely you would think a public school education would be better than a no-frills school. But he thinks if he gets rid of all the extra stuff that you don't need, just focus on education, you can get a better result. So that's all left out. I mean, that's the story of the century almost, how the private sector has been educating the developing world. Nobody knew about it because nobody bothered to look. So, all right, we've said a lot about education. He also wants to talk about healthcare, and we talked about healthcare a million times here. But again, I'm sorry to make this into a greatest hits of the Tom Woods Show, but I think one of the best episodes I ever did was with Dr. Josh Umber, who runs one of these cash-only concierge-type services where for $50 a month, you get, I mean, everything but the kitchen sink in terms of services. And it would just blow your mind how inexpensively he can get your medicine and stuff.
Rich people probably get the kitchen sink, huh? Yeah, I see how it works.
Yeah, that's the difference. But definitely, I mean, that his story is unbelievable. What happens when you get the insurance out and you get Medicare, you get the government completely out? He has a service that is astonishing in terms of how inexpensive it is. He can get the drugs for his patients for pennies on the dollar. It's a glimpse into what real free market medicine would look like. And it's the sort of thing Krugman's never talked about, mentioned, because it is a rebuke to him, a complete rebuke.
Yeah, so this – maybe this is one way to react to Krugman's column here. So even on his own terms, what Krugman is telling the reader is, no, the reason we know that a mix between private and public – ownership or running systems works is because right now in the United States, even we're pretty socialistic, if you will, or a large chunk is. And he says, you know, he lists what right now does the government completely dominate, and it's health, education, social assistance programs, and some administrative stuff. And he doesn't spell this out, but that would include, you know, police, military, the court system. And so I would, and he also says utilities. Like, that's clearly an area where, you know, there's a lot of government regulation, if not outright ownership. And so I would just stop and say to somebody on the left, you know, who's basically in agreement with Krugman's position here, just stop and think about this for a second. Right now, when you're thinking of how American society actually is, not, you know, if the right people were running it, but the way it is in practice right now and has been for the last 20 years, when you think of the healthcare sector, are you like, yeah, that's hitting on all cylinders? That's exactly the way I would say in an ideal world things should be run, is the way healthcare in practice has been administered and run over the last 20 years up to right now. Would you say that? Would you say the way the police conduct themselves in America in 2019, yep, that's basically, you know, your vision for an egalitarian progressive society is the way the police departments in practice operate right now. Would you say that? Or the military, U.S. foreign policy, are you pretty much okay with how government utter control and domination in that sector is playing out? Or education, you know, there, are you pretty happy with the way that, you know, minorities are treated in the school system right now? Is that living up to your ideals of a great society? And in contrast, think about, like, you know, where you buy your clothes, or when you just go to get your groceries at the end of the day, or, you know, geez, your car's acting funny, you got to get an oil change, you go to get your oil change. Do you have any of the problems with those things that are clearly handled by the private sector? You go get your smartphone, a new Blockbuster movie's coming out and you have to go do that. You got to catch a flight somewhere. I mean, a lot of these things, like, where in terms of just institutional problems and where, geez, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in this area of society, would it be more in the areas I first listed or in the latter? And I got to think, if you're being honest with yourself, you would admit that, oh yeah, all the areas where Krugman's telling us the government right now utterly dominates, those are the places where there's institutional racism and this inequality and da-da-da, and like costs are just out of control. And yes, in a lot of those places, your explanation could be, well, because there's still the vestiges of private profit motives and that's distorting everything. But it seems weird to me that the profit motive, where it's allowed to just run rampant, as it were, these other areas, like with smartphones and just clothing and things, it doesn't seem like that's a huge issue taking up a lot of your mental space worrying about, whereas these other areas like healthcare and education and the police and foreign policy, those are areas where, you know, you have to devote all sorts of activism to and raise public awareness to realize the horrors that are happening every day in those areas. And yet those are the ones the government already has its tentacles in. So just throwing this out there, couldn't it be that the causality is the other way around? That it's not that where the government touches is what keeps it safe from private enterprise. Maybe the things that work well is where the government kind of leaves it alone. And that's why it works so well. I think I just convinced everyone, Tom.
You know where you won't convince everyone, because I'll be beating you in a debate, is on funny. The contrary.
At first, I thought you were going to say, because they already agree with us, so there's no need to. But no, I can
just say. No, like, oh, no, no. I'm thinking angle. On a right. much darker it. Level.
Okay, yeah. It's always a competition with you, Woods. You always got to be better. All right.
Well, remember, you know, you did a terrific interview with Gene Epstein on I had a couple of rooms of the house that I really needed to sort out and straighten out. And I thought, well, what am I – I need something that's going to keep me entertained while I do this. And I listened to your terrific interview with Gene Epstein, who's been a guest on our show, on your Bob Murphy Show, which is a new podcast. If you folks haven't started listening to it, I recommend it. And there's a bold statement. I recommend the Bob Murphy Show on Contra Krugman. But it was really great. And as some of you know, Gene, in addition to being a great debater in his own right, is a debate moderator for the Soho Forum. So we thought, as long as he's a special guest on the Contra Cruise, he is going to moderate a debate between Bob and me. And I guess pretty soon, Bob, we will reveal the topic. But it's not a silly topic. It's not, you know, for laughs. It really is actually a serious area of disagreement between Bob and me. And the one new aspect of this year's cruise that people are going to have to be aware of in terms of paperwork they have to fill out is everybody has to sign a release indicating their consent to help carry out Bob's corpse after I'm done with him in the debate.
At first I thought you were going to say, because we're going to film the debate, and so in case – I was no. like, what? We don't have to sign up.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the second time in 2 minutes that you thought I was going to say something reasonable, and you've been wrong. You're 0 for 2. So
yeah.
Anyway, we're going to have a great time on the Contra Cruise. So do please check that out as soon as you can at ContraCruise.com. There'll be a new video up there for you to watch. Maybe it's up now. I don't know if they've had time to put it up. But we got some great new videos showing you what it's like to be on board. But it's so much fun. We hope you'll join us.
Can we say one more thing about Krugman? Are we allowed to?
I think we're a lot. I think I now feel like I run this thing after these dominating statements I've been making. Bob, I hereby allow this.
What do you mean now feel like you? it's your sort of benevolent dictatorship. Yeah, so this, the thing Krugman says in here is about, he talks about utilities. And so, yeah, let's just talk something real mundane. Okay, what works better? Like having the government provide water, you know, to your house or you know, bottled water through the private sector. When there are, you know, catastrophes, clearly, you know, people shipping bottled water. And you could say, okay, that's not fair because, you know, that's more mobile. Okay, but what about like the stuff in Flint, Michigan, you know, where just for... It's more than a year at this point. I forget the exact timeline where the residents there are drinking bottled water because the water coming from the public provision is dangerous. You know, it's harmful to health. I mean, so this is not, you know, oh, the efficiency is 2.6% higher. I mean, real basic stuff that, yes, we say, oh, you know, now we have a modern society or modern economy and we take it for granted that the drinking water that the government provides to you or through a monopolized utility service heavily regulated by the government is safe, but we're just comparing it to third world countries or something when we say that. But it's actually in practice, no, even at this day and age in the United States, it's still the case that certain residents can't trust their drinking water because it's not safe. And you can blame it on, you know, oh, that was because of a GOP administrator, whatever, but that's still a political provision. The political party, whether the guy selling you pizza or something likes Donald Trump, that doesn't make your pizza poisonous, okay? Because people have common sense and they know they're going to lose their customers if they don't give you a good product. Or something like brownouts or blackouts, right? So electricity is heavily regulated and they're going to protect consumers and have price controls in place as far as what the power utilities can charge you for electricity. And that's why in the summer months, there's brownouts or blackouts, depending on where you live. In contrast, Budweiser never says in the middle of July, hey, everybody, there's a lot of demand for our product, so just only drink one beer per day in order to make sure we don't run out. Budweiser never says that, okay? But yet that's exactly what the government-regulated utilities will tell you. Is, hey, why don't you adjust your air conditioner, you know, because otherwise we're going to overload the grid. So just notice all these areas where the government is in charge, that's where you have all these problems. And so, again, that's not a coincidence. There's all sorts of theoretical explanation for why that is. And just once you entertain the notion that maybe government interfering with business leads to bad outcomes, just look around and you'll see that.
And maybe you'll find it's not a coincidence after all. Doggone it, Bob and Tom were right again. Well, I don't know. I'm getting tired of being right all the time, aren't you? Aren't you tired of winning? Intellectually, of course. We lose everything. Intellectually, we win.
You know where you won't win, Tom.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. I guess it all boils down to what you mean by you. Anyway, all right. Yeah. Plus, Bob, I have a different pronoun for you. I haven't mentioned that to you. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. Check out ContraKrugman.com/173 for our show notes and ContraCruise.com for the cruise. See you next week. All right, folks. Now, since this episode was released, we have revealed a couple of things about the debate that we referred to in the episode. The first thing we've revealed is the topic of the debate, and it has to do with pacifism. Now, we've laid it out in a formal resolution, but to make a long story short, Bob is a pacifist and I'm not, and so we're going to debate that. Second thing is we've decided that whoever loses the debate, and remember, with an Oxford-style debate and you do before and after polling, there is an objective winner and loser. The loser has to shave his beard. Bob and I both have beards. And the loser has to shave by the next day so that everybody is still on board and can see clearly this person was the loser. So we're going to have a lot of fun with that. I do hope you can join us. I mean, could you imagine setting sail for Alaska with Bob and me and all these wonderful special guests and good folks who have been with us in the past, many of them, but all wonderful people that you're just going to have a great time with. Can you imagine that not being one of the most memorable times ever? So hop on over to ContraCruise.com and reserve your cabin as soon as you can, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.